Hello, and welcome to a very special virtual author event at the Poison Pen. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is fortunate to have with us five festive authors: Nancy Coco, Maya Corrigan, Maddie Day, Liz Ireland, and Heather Redmond. But before we begin our program, I do have one brief commercial message. If while you're listening to this program, you discover you can't live without one of these authors' books, please feel free to contact the Poison Pen, either by phone or through our website, and we would be happy to send a copy or several copies of any or all of these authors' books to you. And now, without further ado, I'd like to welcome our authors to the Poison Pen. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, my first question to you is, let's start by having you tell us a bit about yourselves before you became a writer and what your path to publication was like. And let's go alphabetical with Nancy Coco first.
Oh, of course, start with me first. No, I work in business. So I'm a marketer and I tell stories in marketing during the day. And then I write my publication stories at night.
And what was it like publishing your first book? Was it
easy? Oh, it was so exciting. No, it was not easy. I had written 17 novels before my first novel got published. So I just decided that if I was going to be a published author, I would just write like one. And so I continued since that day. And I've written 32 more since then.
That's great. Wow. Maya, I think you're up next.
Thank you. I wrote my first novel when I was 13 and showed it to my best friend and waited for her to smile and laugh in the right places. So and she did. So I caught the bug for writing entertaining things. Unfortunately, you don't make a lot of money and you have to think about that. So I ended up spending 15 years in academia and then moving on to teaching English. I have a PhD in English from University of Michigan. And I moved into the business world because I caught the computer bug, and I worked in educational uses of computers for a number of years. So I didn't get to write anything that would entertain anybody between academic papers and technical manuals. It wasn't very entertaining. So I decided to go back to what I really loved. And I have a number of books in the drawer too, not quite as many as Nancy has, but it took a while. And I just lucked out when I figured out that I needed not to try to sell one book, but a whole series, which is what publishers want. And that was sort of the light bulb that made all the difference in the world. Went off in my head and I said, I should try that. And bingo, I got a contract that way.
Maddie?
Yeah, so I earned my first money as a fiction writer when I was 9. I won a contest, a fiction contest in the Pasadena Star News for my short story, The Viking Girl. And I was paid $2. it was a very long time ago. You can see the color of my hair. And then I didn't pick up fiction again really until I was, my younger son went off to kindergarten. And for the first time, I was home with my kids for about 5 years. And I, first time in my life, in my time as a parent, I had every morning to myself, and I started writing a cozy mystery set on an organic farm, which I had one of those at the time. And I have a PhD in linguistics. I had never studied creative writing. I wrote about 2/3 of it, and then the farming season started up, and then I got into a second, third, fifth career as a software technical writer, writing software, those software manuals. And I didn't pick full-time fiction writing, novel writing up again until I was laid off from that job 14 years later. And I had the time and the space until I got a new job to work on a novel. So my first novel came out 2 months before I turned 60, and that was 8 years ago. And I have 23 out, I think, 24, 23, and more in production. And I left the day job seven years ago. So I'm delighted to be a full-time fiction writer.
That's great. Liz?
Well, I guess I caught the theater bug when I was a teenager. And when I was in college, I discovered playwriting. And that's where my serious writing started. That's when I realized it's what I wanted to do. And I won a playwriting award in college. And I think it was $1,500. And so I immediately ran off to New York because I was rich. and within, a week, it was gone. And I realized I had to get a job. So I worked odd jobs and just started writing at night. I was writing everything, short stories that I would send off to the New Yorker and they would be rejected the next week. And so eventually I got a job in publishing at Silhouette Books, which was part of Harlequin. And I started writing romances at that point too in the evening. And I eventually left and went back to my home in Texas. And then I finally got published in romance, and that's how I started. That was back in the 90s. And I just published my first mystery about 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Finally, Heather.
I sold my first short story, which was a mystery, in about 2004. At the time, I was an entrepreneur. I owned a business that brought in people to take care of people on hospice, special needs kids, and that kind of thing. And then after that, I had to relocate, got married, sold my first novel at that point. It was a couple of years later, but I sold the novel. It was a romance, and I was writing as Heather Heastend at the time. So I did a long romance career, started writing for Kensington in 2012. And then in 2018, my first mystery novel came out. So I went full circle back to mystery, took a very mysterious bank robber support person, great grandfather last name to suit the persona. And here I am today.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the book that brought you here with us today. Let's start with Heather this time and work our way back. So tell us about your new book.
So my new book is this one, A Christmas Carol Murder, and it's standalone, but it's the third book in my A Dickens of a Crime series. And if you're a Poison Pen person, you've seen me come in and talk about it live last year. And my series hero is amateur sleuth Charles Dickens, who is a famous novelist who lived from 1812 to 1870 in England. And he's in his early 20s. And as the series begins, he meets his future wife, Kate, and she is his support team. And he's working as a parliamentary reporter. And those pre-Victorian London times were pretty gritty, lots of bodies around. It's the beginning of modern policing. So, there aren't detectives to come and solve crimes. So he and his friend, who's a crime reporter, are bound to solve the crimes that they run across. And that is the basis of the series. I take inspiration from Dickens novels. So A Christmas Carol Murder is obviously taking some cues from A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And you'll find characters like Emmanuel Scrooge and Jacob Harley in my story.
Okay, Liz, tell us about your new book.
Oh, my new book is Mrs. Claus and the Santaland Slayings. And it's set in the North Pole in Santaland. And the heroine, the narrator, is Mrs. Claus. And she's just married Santa about 3 months ago. So she's a newlywed, and they met on vacation because she runs an inn on the Oregon coast. And he had come for vacation one summer and they fell in love, whirlwind romance, but she didn't know who he was. And he had to, break the news to her. So now she's living in the North Pole, and it's her first Christmas at the North Pole. And everything seems to be great. Elves and sentient snowmen and talking reindeer, and everything's fine until there's they have a sculpture contest, an ice sculpture contest, and Santa is judging, and the elf who loses gets very angry and blames Santa for his loss and starts threatening him. And then the next morning, the elf, Giblet, is found dead in his house. And it looks very suspicious, and people are looking at Santa as a suspect. So Mrs. Claus taps her inner sleuth and tries to figure out who killed Giblet. And that's the basic story, her premise.
Maddie, would you tell us about your book?
Yeah, it's Candy Slain Murder. And it's the eighth country store mystery, which features Robbie Jordan, who's a chef and a carpenter. And she runs a country store breakfast and lunch restaurant in Southern Indiana. It's just a lovely part of the world. And in this book, in the first scene, a young man comes into the restaurant and he looks kind of familiar and he wants to speak with Dana, her 21-year-old assistant. And he says he's her brother. And Dana said, I don't have a brother. So that's actually a subplot. We learn that her mother gave up a baby for adoption before she got married to Dana's father. And he has tracked down his birth family. And that same night, Robbie's boyfriend is an electric lineman, and there's a fire in town in a house, in a doctor's house. And as the firefighters are breaking down the attic roof, the roof of the house to put out the fire, Abe is up on a bucket truck trying to fix the wires that went out because it's also a really stormy night. And he spies a skeleton in the attic. So it's a skeleton in the attic of the house that burns down. It might or might not be the wife of the man who lives in the house. His wife disappeared 10 years earlier. And a few days later, that woman's twin sister is murdered in town. So it's a complicated set of events, and Robbie goes to work like after hours and on her day off from the restaurant trying to figure out. And also because this young man who came in, Marcus, he becomes a suspect. He had connections with the contemporary murder, and are the murders connected? Was the skeleton murdered and so forth? And it's all around Christmas, and they're trying to get it solved before actual Christmas.
Maya?
I write the five ingredient mysteries featuring a woman in her 30s, Val, who manages a cafe, and her Livewire grandfather. They live on the eastern shore of Maryland near the Chesapeake Bay. And this is called the five ingredient mystery series because each book has five suspects, five clues to the murder, and granddad's five ingredient recipes. And they are a sleuthing duo. There's almost 50 years between them. So they come at all kinds of things from different perspectives. And they had a little trouble getting used to each other because Val has just moved in with him in the beginning of the series. Now by this book, which is Ginger Dead Man.
Okay. Best title ever.
they are working very well together. And this book takes place during Dickens of a holiday festival in their town of Bayport. The people in town are volunteers dressed as Victorians, and they have different kinds of responsibilities. For example, Val is catering English tea parties throughout the day, and Granddad has been tapped to be Scrooge, and he's a little grumpy because he always, in previous years, he's always been Santa, but a newcomer has usurped his role. So Granddad's bah humbugs are pretty genuine. At the end of the day, when the festival is over, Val is serving a tea to the costume volunteers, and Santa and Mrs. Claus are there. Scrooge is there. The Ghost of Christmas Past and a few other Dickens characters. When someone comes in unexpectedly, dressed head to toe in black, and everyone thinks, oh, this is the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, and just another volunteer. However, the ghost doesn't sit down at the table, but goes around the table, leaves a little gift for each of the volunteers, and then leaves without a word. Santa opens his gift first, and what he finds inside the little gift bag looks like a gingerbread cookie, but it's actually a ginger dead man cookie. So it's a sort of a Halloween cookie that's out of place during a Dickens of a Holiday Festival. Santa, of course, loves sweets, gobbles down the cookie and keels over. Now, this is a particularly suitable way to die, because Val and Granddad soon find out that Santa has a lot of skeletons in his closet. But he is not the only victim. Another person gets a gift of a sweet, eats it, and dies. And the only thing Santa and the second victim have in common is that Val has catered a dinner for them, or some kind of a meal for them. So she has a vested interest in finding out who done it.
Nancy, tell us about your new book.
Sure. I write the Candy Coated Mystery Series, and my new book is Have Yourself a Fudgy Little Christmas. And it's the eighth in the series. When this particular book opens, what's happening is my protagonist, Allie McMurphy, is doing some reconstruction on her hotel and fudge shop, the historic McMurphy Inn. And so she's staying in Francis's old, Francis is her general manager, in her old apartment, when there's a knock on the door and a note left saying, please meet me at the foot, the stairs of the, at the foot of the fort on Mackinac Island. So Allie goes to see who it is and perhaps tell them that Frances is not living in the particular apartment at the time, because she's just moved in with her new husband. And what she finds is a woman in a snowbank. So she calls 911, of course, and luckily this time the woman is not dead. So she feels like, okay, things can move on and she can celebrate Christmas. And she goes to work with Frances and her husband. And what they're doing is creating a lighting scene for the Lights Festival in the park. And what they discover is that the woman did die eventually, unfortunately, and her last word was Frances. So of course, Frances is now kind of troubled that maybe she is a suspect in this woman's murder and how it all connects. And there's a second murder that happens, and that murder is caused by someone who has eaten candy, and he lives in Francis's old apartment complex. So the only connection between the two is, of course, Francis. So Allie and the seniors that she works with on the island get together to figure out who done it.
My next question for you is, all of you have written holiday kind of flavored mysteries. There's a long tradition of Christmas and mysteries going back to Agatha Christie, whose publisher billed her books as Christie for Christmas. What is it about Christmas-centered mysteries that are so popular with readers? And why do you think the holidays drive people to homicide? So I'll just throw that out to you.
Well, that last part's easy. I mean, okay. You know, this year is fraught for different reasons. I mean, I'm personally kind of can't get over the fact that I'm going to have Christmas on Zoom with my kids. Like, that's just, but other than this Christmas, you're with people, there's a lot of expectations, You want to set the perfect table. You want to make all the cookies your mother made. You want to find the perfect gift and wrap it pretty. And like, and then you bring people together and there are long, you know, long-standing resentments and relatives, all those things about dinner with the relatives, like Thanksgiving brings up too. It just seems to me there's a lot of potential for harm.
I think too, Christmas is a season of stories. My child has half a shelf full of Christmas books that we pull out every year. I'm not sure we can even get through them. So from the earliest babyhood, we're raising them on the story of the Christmas child and all of the wonderful Christmas picture books. So it just is a natural time for stories, for storytelling. It gets dark early. There's lots of lights around and it's just a very special pocket of time. And if you're a natural storyteller like we all are, you're going to come up with something set around the season. For me too, coming out of a long romance career, there's nothing better than a Christmas baby story. And so much about families reuniting at this time, which then of course goes to what Maddie is saying. Not all family reunions are happy moments. And there's also a lot of parties. My book starts with a Christmas caroling adventure gone wrong. So all sorts of different things that could be happening in this one special month of the year.
I think too that the mysteries, or especially cozy mysteries, do well when there's just a very tight community and kind of set parameters within the world of the novel. And there's something about the holidays where everything is kind of scripted in advance, and it's a very familiar world for a lot of people, and so it's a natural place to go to for a cozy mystery, I think. It's just, it's a kind of universal experience of having some kind of holiday with the get-togethers, the traditions, the potential for things to go wrong every time.
I think I had a hard time figuring out how to put a murder in the middle of this holly jolly season. And I started to think about the traditions a little bit. For example, the Agatha Christie book you were talking about, the Hercule Poirot's Christmas, is really a very dark book. It's one of her darkest ones. And in fact, her original title for it was Blood Feast. So that kind of tells you, you know, what was in her mind. And then because of the Christie for Christmas, it got a Christmas title that I don't know how well it fits, but the other thing, of course, is Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which really starts and continues for a long time to be about death. I mean, the first line is Marley was dead to begin with. And then it's a very dark tale until it gets to a very brief happy ending. And I think really that's the mystery structure too. You start with somebody dead, and you go through a lot of dark things kind of in trying to, you know, really deal with the fact that this is supposed to be a jolly time of year and it's somehow being spoiled by this murder. But in the end, you get to the happy ending where justice is served and you figure it all out and you can sit down at a table as the characters in A Christmas Carol do with food, family, and friends and enjoy what really matters at Christmas.
I totally agree. In my book, it really, really revolves around family and Francis's family. So it was easy to kind of come up with that murder and then the suspect and then have some family joy and holiday included in that story.
I have a question for those of us who have two murders in a book, if I can jump in. Sometimes if I'm writing along and I'm getting kind of stuck in the middle, as I invariably do, I just kill off somebody else because that it adds a whole new thing and it keeps it moving forward. Did you put in a second murder because you needed to spice up the book? Or?
I like to put in a second murder because it flips who the suspect list might be. You can kill off one of the suspects and then that changes everyone's attention and it also creates new suspects.
Yeah.
My second murder came exactly Edith exactly why he did. I'm like, oh my gosh, something has to happen, something that will move this story along a little bit better and open up the pool of suspects. So second murder it is.
I'm glad I'm not alone.
Well, I actually planned this second murder from the very beginning because I gave myself the challenge of writing a book in which the victims have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. I've had a second murder before, but it's always been the second person was murdered because he or she saw something that would incriminate the person who is the murderer, or else has some connection to the dead person, to the person who initially murdered. In this case, no connection. And so it was a real challenge for me to figure out how to make these two murders work and all the possibilities that exist for that kind of crime, that set of crimes.
We always need new challenges.
My next question is for Maddie, Maya, and Nancy. All of you have a culinary component in your mystery series. How do you come up with the recipes in the book? Talk a little bit about putting food into the mysteries. Why don't we start with Maddie?
Well, I love cooking, so that part's easy. I also blog at Mystery Lovers Kitchen on the second and fourth Fridays, and I have to come up with an original recipe twice a month, like all year. Sometimes I will, in the Christmas book, I can use an old family recipe. I have the family that's reunited with the birth son make a beef stew. It's December, and I love making a big beef stew, so I just use my recipe. Other times I might find a recipe online or in a book and adapt it in my own way. Occasionally, a reader will give me a recipe. There's a something in Indiana called a sugar cream pie, and I have a fan who loves making that. She's a Hoosier, and so she sent me the recipe, and I used Jane Carter's sugar cream pie a couple books ago. So it varies, but it's fun to find, new recipes and interesting. And I usually have different kinds of recipes. I'll have a savory recipe. I'll have a dessert. I usually have a drink in there, a cocktail or an alcoholic kind of drink of some kind, depending on the season.
Nancy?
Well, I started cooking when I was 5. So I made my first scratch cake at 5, and I did a lot of 4-H cooking. So I've always kind of been in the kitchen. I was known as the cookie lady for a while, and then I started my hand at candy. So for me, it's really fun to just get in the kitchen and play. It's another kind of creative setting. But a lot of times I'll ask people, so what kind of fudge, if you could have any kind of fudge you want, because I do a lot of fudges, of course, in my fudge series. And what kind of fudge would you have? And for one book, somebody told me, well, I want a Captain Morgan fudge. Can you make a Captain Morgan fudge? Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I went to an old book of 1950s cocktails and recreated the cocktails as different fudges. So that was a lot of fun to practice and see how that would work. So different ideas like that is what I do when I'm creatively coming up with recipes.
Maya?
I confess to enjoying eating more than cooking. And when I decided that I wanted to write a culinary mystery, it was because I think a lot about food. But I didn't have the background that Nancy has of having cooked and won blue ribbons for cooking. I was just a mom who had to put dinner on the table for a family and do it quickly because I had 2 part-time jobs. And so I always looked for recipes that didn't have a lot of ingredients and wouldn't take me a long time to prepare. And I'd cut them out of magazines. And my mother was the same kind of cook. So now I often go back either to her index cards of recipes or my own, or else since I started writing the 5 ingredient mysteries, all my friends give me a 5 ingredient cookbook whenever they run across them, and you would be amazed how many there are. Now, I get my recipes from different sources, as just as Edith says she does, but because I'm used to cooking, I frequently change them even before I try them, because I think, well, I'm gonna like it better if I use this spice, or I change out which meat is being used or whatever. So I don't usually end up with anything that's much like what I started out with. But the reason, I have to tell you, the reason I love writing a mystery about books, about food, is that I use food really as a characterizing device. People sitting around the table, how they behave, their likes and dislikes with respect to foods, their hang-ups about foods. These are all great characterizing details. And of course, Val and Granddad spend a lot of time together in the kitchen. So they're discussing suspects and what each of them has found out during the day in terms of the murder that has taken place. And so they're doing this as they prepare food. So I have kind of, I don't have to say he said, she said, I can say, you know, he slapped the hamburger into the frying pan, and we know that he's kind of annoyed by how he does this. So I love just the business of preparing foods, eating it, cleaning up afterwards as an opportunity to share information between people.
Let's talk a little bit about the research that you do for your books, because whether it's a contemporary novel or a historical novel, there usually is something you don't know that you have to find out about. So I'd like to start first with Heather, because what made you choose that time period for your setting, and talk a little bit about the research you do for your books.
I loved reading historical novels from way back, and I was afraid to write one myself because of all the research. But my first Victorian story was a short story, and it came to me in a dream. It was kind of a Victorian princessy fantasy story. So that sort of counts. At least it's putting me in the 19th century. But I also like to read Victorian novels. I was reading Charles Dickens for pleasure from way back. So his books and books about him are, of course, where I'm starting my research. I'm coming up with themes and motifs from the story I choose. So back to Christmas Carol, I was coming up with what's happening in this book and how I can translate it into a murder mystery that people would like to read about. And then I'm looking at the environment. Charles Dickens was a person who walked London all hours of the day and night. So I'm trying to really learn about the streets of London, looking at different neighborhoods he can go into. You know, where would a counting house be? What would the bastard half-Irish son of a counting house owner live? And what would he do for a living? So like for this book, I learned a little bit about the weaving business. And then because Charles lived about 5 miles away from his fiance's house, I'm looking at what was going on in those 5 miles in between Yorkshire Place and Furnival's Inn. And there's a lot of new construction and different neighborhoods coming and going, and what sort of people are living there. And I'm always trying to learn more about what really was happening with crime management back then. Who are the police? Who are the coroners? What did the coroner's court look like? My editor was horrified to see me leaving a body lying around for days. But at that time, that may really have happened. It happened sometimes. Sometimes they moved the body. It depended on where the body was. Their standards were not today's standards. So educating myself and then educating the reader peripherally as I understand what was actually happening back then. Every decade of the 19th century provides you with a different set of realities in terms of crime and attitudes. So for me, it's just really fun to dig in and learn what would happen if someone was murdered in one of those years, and it would not be the same answer each year.
Interesting. Liz, was there any research involved in Santa?
Well, part of the reason I wanted to go to Santa Land in a complete fantasy situation was I had been writing a historical mystery series before that called that was set in it's set in New York in the 19 teens. And so there was a lot of research involved in that. And, you know, when I'm sure Heather and everyone who's written anything historical knows, you have to worry about every line practically. You know, are you using idioms that are anachronistic? Are you, you know, there's just so much to worry about. What are they, you know, looking at? What are they, you know, eating, things like that. And so I just jumped at the chance. I thought, oh, I can just go to the North Pole and I don't have to research at all. I'll just watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and I'm done. But then I got into it and I realized there's a lot of fantasy world building. I had never written a fantasy novel. And you really have to sort of it's not research so much, but just the planning of what the parameters are for the world that you're building. And there do end up, you know, you have to research certain things just in terms of the plot and the story and, you know, what poisons cause what and what do reindeers eat and things like that. So there has been some research just involved in various, you know, things about what can live at the North Pole and things like that. But at the same time, it's a complete fantasy story. So sometimes I'll find myself overthinking, like, how can he get from, you know, how does the sleigh ride work? And then I realize it's Santa Land. I have to remind myself, this is not real. There are certain things that are just off in complete cloud cuckoo land up there. So it's been a fun balance though.
Nancy?
I like to go to Mackinac Island. It's actually a place. I had a reader ask me, is that a real place? And it is. I like to go there and spend some time because they don't allow cars on the island. So it's all very Victorian with horses and buggies and carriages and bicycles. So that's a lot of fun. And I have to be really careful. I have like an imaginary overlay of Mackinac Island in my book. So it's not exactly Mackinac Island, but it's an imaginary part of Mackinac Island. But a lot of people are very, you know, if it's a place you can go to, you have to really know what you're talking about and who's where and what things look like. So I do a lot of Google as well, because I don't live there. I live in Texas. But I grew up around in Michigan and around Mackinac Island. So that's how I got to the place. So I do a lot of Google, and I do Google image searches and Google Maps, where they let you kind of walk around the island picture wise. So that's a lot of fun to do.
Addie?
I love doing historical research. As Edith Maxwell, I write a historical series of Quaker Midwest mysteries set in around 1890 in the United States. but for this book, I did all kinds of bits of research. So I had to figure out what a corpse would be like 10 years later in a dry, cold attic. And I got advice from D.P. Lyons, who wrote Forensics for, what is it? Forensics for Writers or whatever it is. He's a doctor and he knows all about this stuff, and you can just ask him questions. So I got some tips on what would be left in this body and what could be tested and what couldn't. The half brother that shows up also converted to Islam as a teenager, and which I don't know anything about. But author Julia Spencer Fleming, who's going to be Poison Pen next week, her daughter converted to Islam as a teenager, and her daughter was very helpful. We had a long phone conversation, so I could put some realism into that experience for him. One of the suspects is an anesthesiologist, and I wanted to figure out, is there a drug anesthesiologists use that could kill somebody, and what is it, and how long does it last, and how long does it take, and all that. So there's always those kind of bits of research in every single book. even if it's the eighth book in the series where I know the setting and I know the town and all that.
Maya?
I had a lot of more research than I thought with this story. Let's start with Santa. I have a Santa who's not such a good guy. And the first thing Val notices about him is that he has dark roots to his beard and his hair. And she wonders why someone whose face is so unlined would try to make himself look older. And so one of the things I needed to find out, and of course, obviously he has a background, and I needed to find out how long it would take to grow a beard like that if you wanted to use a beard as a disguise, and how you go about dyeing your hair and beard. And I was at a book event in Southern Virginia, and a writer walked by who had a really nice white beard. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna ask him, you know, so I walked up to him and I said, excuse me, but you know, explained who I was, why I wanted to know, could you tell me how long it took you to grow that beard? And he told me, and he said, you're putting a Santa in there? I'm a professional Santa. And he said he works at Busch Gardens in Southern Virginia. And he gave me all kinds of information about what it means to be a Santa today. For example, one of the things you have to worry about is that if you're taking a picture with a child, your hands are visible at all times, you know, because otherwise, you know, there may be questions about what you're doing with that kid on your knee and so on. And his wife was there, and she is the Mrs. Santa at Busch Gardens. And I talked to her for a long time, and she told me all about how, you know, they dealt with children. So, and I also found out that there is something called the IBRBS, which is the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas. Who would know that any such thing existed? So the Santa research was fun. And the other thing that I often find myself doing, because I write culinary mysteries, is looking into the history of the food that's kind of at the center, because most of my books have a title that refers to a food, and often that food has a very interesting history. And that is very true of gingerbread, and gingerbread men in particular. They have a historical association with death and the demonic. It was really fun to go into that as well, although not a lot of that gets into the book. It was just some great background.
All of you have written successful series. As an author, what are the advantages to a series and what are the challenges? And I'll just throw that open to whoever wants to start.
With a series, you're always reselling the first book over and over again. It's almost like you're writing the rest of the series to support the first book because you want to bring in people to the series. And so that is definitely one of the challenges. One of the lovely things is you already know your main characters and your, what I call your Scooby gang, your group of reoccurring characters that you see. And people want to come and learn more about their lives, especially in the cozy environment. So what's going on with Kate and Charles' engagement? You know, are they ever going to be able to get to the altar? What about their friends? Are they really going to have a baby, or will there be a miscarriage again? So there's a whole lot of goodwill you have from your audience as you write a series and each book comes out, and you have a lot of investment in the characters, which is really nice. It's fun to see who the favorite characters are with your readers.
I would agree that, and you know, our fans, it's like their family, and they love coming back to this setting and the characters over and over again. My seventh country store mystery, Not So Average Murder, Robbie goes to Southern California, to Santa Barbara for her 10th high school reunion. I'm a Californian, like I loved doing the research, of course, in February, going to Santa Barbara, but and it was a great book and people loved it, but so many of my fans say, oh, I'm so glad she's going back to Southwick. Oh, I miss Southwick, the name of the fictional town. So that's a big part of it, that they, that's one of the joys of writing a series, that the fans get so attached to the Scooby gang, the cast of characters. And then that challenge of getting that stuff out of the way for the new reader who jumps in at book eight and does not know how that Robbie was able to buy the store because her mother died suddenly. And, you know, those background things, to weave those in kind of lightly and not bore the reader who's been with you since book one. You know, the Kinsey Mill home. Well, I'm a detective and I love this. Sue Grafton would just get that out of the way, you know, somewhere in the first couple pages, just get it out of the way. So that's a challenge of the continuing series, is how do you satisfy your longtime readers and your brand new readers?
One of the things I do to make it more interesting for myself is with the seventh book, I'm up to seven books. I did a little reset, you know, maybe every couple of books. The first, my main character, Val, runs a cafe at an athletic club. And the first few of the books in the series revolved a lot around that location and the people who worked with her and the people who met in her cafe there. And then I thought, well, I need just a little bit of a change for her. And so she took on a job as a part-time caterer for small dinner parties, usually in people's homes. And that got her to meet a number of different people that she otherwise didn't meet in the first three books. And also I'm setting my book in a tourist town. So there are people who are coming there to have weddings, they're coming there to sightsee, they're coming there to boat, they're coming there to retire. So there is a changing cast of characters. And I did another reset around book six when a bookstore opened in the town. And now Val is getting to do some book events that she's preparing foods for. So just a little bit of a change so that I at least, you know, have something a little different to do. And I hope the readers enjoy adding to what's going on in the series.
Well, one of the things I like about my series is I explore the cast of characters that revolve around Allie. So like her general manager, Francis, married Mr. Devaney, Douglas Devaney, who was her in the second book, turned out to be her, oh my gosh, I can't think of the word, but he does he's the handyman. So the two meet, and then over the course of another book or two, they have a romance, and then you actually get to see them get married. So that's fun to kind of explore all of the characters in the book, as well as Allie. And then what I found is that readers will take sides because Allie has two guys that she's sort of seeing off and on, and who I thought would be the boyfriend, none of the readers liked. So I ended up having to kind of change how I was looking at who Allie was picking and why based on my reader's response. So that was really interesting and also a challenge.
I think that one of the challenges too is trying to keep all the characters that the readers enjoy without just letting the number of secondary characters balloon past the point where everything is manageable in the plot. And I think it was Laurie King I heard talking about this situation, because she's been writing her series for so long, and she was saying you have to, you know, pick the secondary characters that you want to focus on in each book. They don't all have to come back. Because I was thinking, oh well, you have to just keep, you know, just having them all there, and I think it's true, you have to, you know, decide which ones really belong in the story, and you know, give a brief update on maybe the ones that aren't there present as much as they were in the past. So,
okay, let's switch gears a little bit. I always like to hear what authors are reading. So what have you read this year or recently that you'd love to share with other readers? Why don't we start with you, Liz?
Well, I am late to this, but I just started reading Gigi Pandian's Accidental Alchemist series about the alchemist. Here, I have a copy of the second one here. This is the Masquerading Magician, but the story is about an alchemist. She's hundreds of years old and she's just resettling into Portland, Oregon, and she unlocks and unpacks one of her trunks, and there's a gargoyle who has hitched a ride in her luggage, and he's a talking gargoyle and he loves to cook, and the whole story is about he's turning to stone. He's you know, able to move around, but he's slowly he has to worry about being turned to stone permanently, and they're trying to figure out a way to save him. And I think it goes on for several books, but I'm only on the second book, but it's wonderful. I love it.
I love that series.
Yeah.
Maya?
Well, I've been finding 2020 something of a challenge, and I just went back to my comfort read, Jane Austen, and have been reading, you know, I generally reread a Jane Austen book at least once a year. And this year I have also read books in which Jane Austen figures. And the one wonderful book that I really love was The Jane Austen Society.
Oh, yes.
Natalie Jenner is the author. And it is set after World War II in England, in Chawton, the town where Jane Austen lived. And it concerns a group of people who have been scarred in various ways by the war. And it is just a fabulous read for anybody. You don't really have to be a real Janeite in order to appreciate it. And so when I finished that, I went for something a little lighter called Camp Austen, which is about a weekend spent, a young man whose mother is a Jane Austen scholar, is sent to a weekend, and a long weekend, like 4 days, in which all of the people who are crazy about Jane Austen get together and they do the dances and they dress, you know, as they, as you see when, if you watch one of those Jane Austen things on PBS, you know, so they are just real Jane Austen fans. And it is a very funny book and very light and also heartwarming. So the Camp Austen is what it's called.
Nancy?
Well, I've been doing a lot of reading on like story structure and tension and that sort of thing. I always like to polish my skills when it comes to writing, and this year has been time to really sit back and say, okay, what kind of things can I do to improve my writing? But when I'm not, I'm reading Risky Biscuits by Mary Lee Ashford. That's a really fun book. She has a lot of fun titles. Her first title was Game of Scones. So if you get a chance, I would recommend those books.
Maddie?
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought I would be reading much lighter and funnier books, like during lockdown, especially in the spring. And instead I read through all the Shetland, Ann Cleaves, all the Shetland books and all the Vera books, which are not particularly light and funny, particularly the Shetland books. And I love them so much. I recently read my first ton of French. It's called The Searcher. You know, friends of mine love Tana French, and I'd never read her. And my son gave me her new book for my birthday, and I went, oh, and I absolutely loved it. I finished Murder at the Mina House by Erica Ruth Neubauer. Great book. I think it's set around 1920. It's set in Egypt. And I hadn't read any of her books, and I was on a panel with her at VoucherCon. Oh, my goodness, excuse me. My phone is ringing. and now I'm halfway through Kate Conte, aka Liz Mugavero's A Whisker of a Doubt. It's her latest Cat Cafe cozy, fabulous. And I'm also on my Kindle, I'm reading Summer of 74 and The Boy Detective. It's Art Taylor's series of short stories. Wonderful, wonderful book about a boy detective.
Heather?
The last book I recommended on my BookBub was The Witches by Stacy Schiff. I started into family history 3 or 4 years ago. So as I learn who my colonial ancestors were, like one of the magistrates for the Salem Witch Trials, nothing to be proud of being descended from him, of course, but I'm always curious to learn more. And for Dickens this year, I went through the Pickwick Paper on audio. His second great grandson, Gerald Dickens, did a wonderful version with all the voices and such. And the fourth Dickens book will have Pickwick aspects. And then I did a read along with Dickens' Hard Times, which I'm working on now. So those are the Dickens reads. And then this last week for me has been Philip Margolin. He's a puzzle-based thriller writer, a former criminal defense lawyer. And he spoke at my Sisters in Crime group this past week. So I was going through his books so I would have questions to ask. And that was a lot of fun. I just finished A Perfect Alibi last night. And now I get to decide which of all these Christmas books I get to read. I'm a definite Maddie Day fangirl. So I need to get caught up so I can read the Christmas book.
Thank you.
I think we do have a few questions from your readers. So we're gonna go ahead and take those now.
Cozies revolve around a theme. How do you select your theme?
The question was, cozies revolve around a theme. How do you select your theme? And we'll open that up.
I can answer that. Sometimes the title of the book gives me the theme. For example, I have a book called Final Fondue. And so I think about the emotional aspects of the food, chocolate fondue associated with love, associated with Valentine's Day, chocolate fountains at weddings. And so that whole book revolved around love and both the dark side and the sweet side, like dark chocolate would. So that was one of the things that gave me just the whole idea of it. Another one was The Telltale Tart. I had that title. I wanted to use the title. I wanted to write a book about the publishing world because I was thinking a lot about Harper Lee having been sort of encouraged to publish something that for 50 years she never intended to publish. And so I wanted to deal with an aging best-selling author and the kind of pressures on that person. And I married it to The Telltale Tart. And I thought, well, Poe had all kinds of problems with publishers, difficulty getting paid for his work. And so that book ends up having a cast of characters, all of whom are associated in some way with Poe, a Poe actor, a writer who bases his books on Poe, someone who looks like Poe and wants to be like him. So, and it does explore themes that Poe explores. So those are the ways, it's incredible to think that the title has that much effect on the theme, but for me, it often does.
For me in Candy Slane Murder, I wanted to bring in this idea of birth families reuniting. This happened to someone I'm close to. And it worked out fine. It worked out great. And anyway, and then it turned out the book kind of found its own theme of family because we had these twin sisters and they were both killed. One of the suspects is staying with her elderly Hungarian grandfather. So she flees town because she knows she's taking care of her brother, who is both disabled and in prison. And it kind of evolved on its own, starting with the birth family reuniting subplot, all these other family subplots. Although really all my books are about family. But this book is particularly, that's really the theme of Candy Slane Murder, which is appropriate for a holiday book too.
I think too, it depends on what aspect of the characters I'm trying to focus on at the time. So the first book with Mrs. Claus, it's more of a focus on trust, and she's just married this person she didn't know very well. He's Santa, that was one thing to get over. Now she has to figure out how far to trust him when he's a suspect in a murder. And the next book is there, she's going to be focused more on her friendships, how to maintain these friendships in hard times. And I try to let the story kind of pick the theme too, in terms of where I want the characters to go.
I write two series, and obviously my Dickens series, I'm looking to the Dickens novels themselves for themes like the past coming back to haunt you when you're taking inspiration from A Christmas Carol. And I also write the journaling mysteries, and my amateur sleuth Mandy Meadows has just gotten a divorce as the first book, Journal to Death, starts. So I'm building the themes for this series around her getting her life back together. You know, what do you do with your ex-husband? How do your friendships change as your marriage has ended? Who's going to be around you at your new job as you realize you need a promotion to get that health insurance covered? And just taking a lot of cues from the life of someone in their mid-30s who's starting over.
I use a lot of fish out of water themes. When I was growing up, we moved around a lot, so I always felt like a fish out of water where everyone else was a community. And I was new to the community and trying to figure out how to navigate that community. And I've actually had readers write me letters thanking me for that, because they often feel like a fish out of water, and it's something that they can identify with.
I think we had one more question from Facebook.
Do you use your real life situations in your books?
Do you use real life situations in your books?
I've used real life situations in my books. For example, my second book, Scam Chowder, is all about scams against retirees. And I was inspired to write about that because my father, who had always taught us you never get anything for nothing, was really falling for these, you know, telephone scams. You know, he wanted me to drive him to the bank because somebody was there with a check for him. And I thought, how does this happen? And it happens a lot. I mean, it turns out when I did some research that that this type of activity where you're trying to cheat older people is one is a huge business, second only in terms of the amount of money involved to drug dealing. So it's just an incredibly hard crime to get your hands around, and because there are all kinds of problems prosecuting it, and I go into some of that in the book. So that was definitely one that was inspired by my life experience.
I use certain aspects of real life, and I'm always listening for stories or situations and even expressions people use. Like my elves tend to curse like Saskatchewan school teachers, because I know someone from there who says has funny expressions coming out of her sometimes. So, but I try not to use my real life or people I know and their problems if it's a real thing, but details, yes, I do pick from real life all the time.
I take cues from my hobbies. So I had started bullet journaling a few years ago, and my journaling mysteries came out of that hobby. So the heroine runs a bullet journal business as well as being a barista. And I have spent a lot of time at hospital coffee shops over the last decade or so. So it was a very, very familiar environment. And then I take a lot of cues from family history from the Dickens books, because I know who my ancestors were in the 1800s and what they were doing. So I'll get interesting names from the family trees and careers and like rivalries from 200 years ago and stick them into my books.
I'm always listening. I'm one of those people. I try not to be too creepy, but whenever I'm out in public, I listen to how people talk and things that come up. And I like to reflect that in my books, but nothing where anyone is really like close to me or someone that I know. I haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I'm more like, I'm a voyeur, you know, in terms of mannerisms and how people talk and stuff, but I certainly don't know of anybody finding a skeleton in an attic. You know, those kind of major plot points are completely out of this imagination. But how people walk and what they look like and what their nose looks like and all that, those weird expressions, those come from real life.
I can't believe how fast time has flown, but before we go, I want each of you to tell us what readers can look forward to next from you. And why don't we start with you, Liz?
Okay, my next book is another Mrs. Claus book. It's going to come out, I guess, probably in August of 2021. And it's called Mrs. Claus and the Halloween Homicide. And it's a Halloween story.
Holiday mashup.
Yes.
Maya?
My next book is not coming out for a while, probably early 2022. And that's because I had a very heavy travel schedule this year. And I didn't want to stick to that one book every 9 months or one book every year. So I negotiated a later release time. And of course, none of that travel happened, but it's in the publisher's massive spreadsheet for that's when my book is coming out. And Val and Granddad will be there, and Granddad is going to be taking part in a bake-off at a mystery convention.
Nancy?
My next book is actually the first in a new series for Nancy Coco. And it's going wide. It's Death Becomes Her, and it releases wide on my birthday, January 26th. So that will be fun to do. It's a honeycomb Oregon mystery series. So it's set on the coast of Oregon.
Maddie?
Yeah, I have a book going to wide distribution. It's been on an exclusive this year. It's the second Cozy Capers book group mystery as Maddie Day. It's called Murder at the Taffy Shop, and it'll be out at the end of March. In April, my seventh Quaker Midwife mystery, Turning a Dark Corner, will be out. And my next Country Store mystery is No Greater Crime, G-R-A-T-E-R, and that'll be out next fall.
Heather.
My next release is the second journaling mystery, Tattooed to Death, and it's officially out January 5th of next year, so a month from today, although it's in limited distribution now. I think it's out in the UK, so there's a few copies around, but officially January 5th. And then my next Dickens book will be The Pickwick Murders, and it's out on Halloween.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you all so much. And thank you for joining us at the Poison Pen for another virtual author event.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having
us.
It's
great.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Kings River Life magazine now has a mystery podcast called Mystery Rat's Maze. Episodes consist of short stories and first chapters of mystery novels read by local actors. To listen to the episodes and subscribe to the podcast, go to mysteryratsmaze.podbean.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more.